compared to hundreds of millions of people who have been given the vaccine. It also is disclaimed and stipulated by Regeneron that the COVID monoclonal antibody treatment could interfere with your own body's ability to fight off future COVID infections and reduce your immune response to vaccination against coronavirus. That is a mouthful. And all of these people saying, well, the vaccine's experimental, so are the antibodies, and no longer is the vaccine experimental, at least not the Pfizer. And I don't want those side effects from the vaccine. Look at the list of possible side effects from the monoclonal antibody treatment. I'm not against the treatment. When it is the appropriate treatment, it can be a really great thing. Works better than placebo. You've got to be sick, though. I would prefer not to get sick in the first place, but a very good voicemail and an important topic. And yet another thing to keep in mind about those advocating for the monoclonal antibodies instead of the vaccine when they are two completely different things. The antibodies are a tool if you get sick, but we have other tools to try to prevent us from getting sick in the first place. On the bonus show today, we will talk about the Ghislaine Maxwell guilty verdicts, 5 out of 6 charges. We will talk about states hoarding welfare funds, even as the need for aid grows. And we are going to talk about the imminent increase of the California minimum wage to $15 per hour. All of those stories and more on today's bonus show. Sign up at...
Would you like to take the sounds of your favorite radio station to places you never thought possible? Well, now you can, because WRCT is live on the internet. Just point your browser to www.wrct.org and click on our live MP3 broadcast. Now you can go out of town without any feelings of loss or regret for leaving us behind, because we're just a mouse click away. WRCT, live on the internet. Because why should Pittsburgh have all the fun?
Depose from the faint. Do you think I'm hot? You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
Nuclear Holocaust. It's a very serious problem, and one that faces all of us. Fortunately, here at WRCT Pittsburgh, we broadcast from a steel-reinforced concrete basement. So we'll be playing music long after your sorry corpse has evaporated in a blinding flash of light and heat. I hope this thought comforts you. WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Now and forever.
Hello, my fellow Americans. I would just like to say now, as an expert on the subject, that WRCT Pittsburgh does not blow. Thank you.
WRCT, in sound, from way out.
RCT Pittsburgh. Meaty and full of flavor since 1949.
Yo, what's up? How y'all doing out there in Techno Land? RCT Techno DJs in the house. Oh yeah, bringing you the only fat beats in Pittsburgh. Right here on WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM.
Folks, glad you could join me for all the best, the smoothest of the smooth, the cool and gentle sounds of what we call jazz.
Tired of the fluffy stuff? At WRCT Pittsburgh, jazz is a one-syllable word.
We'll be right back.
WRCT. In sound. From way out. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
We are definitely in the middle of a very severe surge and uptick in cases. If you look at the upstick, it is actually almost a vertical increase. We're now at an average of about 400,000 cases per day. Hospitalizations are up.
As COVID cases skyrocket, we speak to Dr. Peter Hotez at Texas Children's Hospital about the Omicron surge and his groundbreaking work developing a patent-free coronavirus vaccine. Israel has just given it emergency approval.
There wasn't enough attention paid to an unfussy, simple, durable, easy-breezy vaccine for resource-poor countries, which is what we've been doing. And hopefully now we can move this along pretty quickly.
It's India that has just given it emergency approval. Plus, as the nation faces a shortage of rapid COVID tests, we'll speak to an MIT scientist who developed an inexpensive rapid test nearly 2 years ago, but the FDA refused to approve it. We'll also go to Colorado, where two people are feared dead after a devastating climate change-fueled wildfire destroyed nearly 1,000 homes outside Boulder.
Climate change is here now. That this is not some future threat that we have to deal with at some point someday, but this is here and now.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Global coronavirus cases have surged to their highest level of the pandemic, with nearly 1.5 million confirmed cases a day, driven largely by the fast-spreading Omicron variant. Here in the U.S., where hospitalizations are rising rapidly and more than 400,000 people are testing positive daily, many cities held muted New Year's Eve celebrations. In New York City, some 15,000 people still gathered in Times Square to witness the iconic ball drop. New York State reported a record of over 85,000 new cases New Year's Eve. Health experts warn even though a lower percentage of people infected with Omicron end up hospitalized, the sheer number of infections is pushing the healthcare system past its breaking point. This is top U.S. infectious disease expert Dr. Anthony Fauci.
Even if you have a less of a percentage of severity, when you have multi-fold more people getting infected, the net amount is you're still going to get a lot of people that are going to be needing hospitalization. And that's the reason why we're concerned about stressing and straining the hospital system.
Hospitalizations among children hit new records, with COVID-related admissions increasing by 66% in the last week of December, though the number of fatalities remains comparatively low. This comes as millions of students across the United States return to school today. Education Secretary Miguel Cardona said Sunday in-person learning is a priority, but that bumps in the road are expected amidst the current surge. In related news, economists are warning mounting infections and the loss of the increased pandemic-related child tax credit could lead to serious financial hardship for millions of families. Travel disruptions continued into the new year, with over 2,600 flights canceled on January 1st in the U.S. alone due to a combination of severe winter weather and sick staff. More than 14,000 flights were canceled over the last 10 days. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin is the latest high-profile government official to test positive for COVID. He's fully vaccinated and boosted and has reported mild symptoms.
In Colorado, two people are missing and presumed dead after a fast-spreading wildfire tore through the suburbs of Boulder County, destroying at least 1,000 homes and businesses. The fires were fanned by winds that gusted up to 110 miles per hour. They capped a year of exceptional drought across the western U.S. and came amidst an unusually warm December. Louisville, Colorado resident Paul Bassa saw his home nearly destroyed in the blaze.
Climate change is here now. That this is not some future threat that we have to deal with at some point someday, but this is here and now. People lost their belongings, their memories that were in those homes, families that were raised there.
Later in the broadcast, we'll go to Boulder to speak with Dr. Jennifer Balch, director of the Earth Lab at the University of Colorado, about the climate change-fueled fire. A New York jury convicted Ghislaine Maxwell of federal sex trafficking charges for helping Jeffrey Epstein recruit and sexually assault teenage girls. The British socialite was found guilty of 5 of 6 counts and faces up to 65 years in prison. During the 3-week trial, 4 survivors recounted being abused at the hands of Maxwell and Epstein, who killed himself in a Manhattan jail in 2019. In a statement, survivor and witness Annie Farmer said, quote, "I hope this verdict brings solace to all who need it and demonstrates that no one's above the law. Even those with great power and privilege will be held accountable when they sexually abuse and exploit the young," she said. British royal Prince Andrew is now under intensified scrutiny. Following the verdict, another Epstein survivor, Virginia Giuffre, tweeted, quote, "Maxwell did not act alone. Others must be held accountable." Giuffre has accused Maxwell of trafficking her to Prince Andrew when she was 17. On Friday, a federal judge rejected a bid from Andrew's lawyer to dismiss Giuffre's lawsuit on the grounds that she no longer resides in the U.S. She lives in Australia. A New York court is set to unseal a confidential 2009 settlement between Epstein and Giuffre today, and Prince Andrew's lawyers are expected to argue again for a dismissal of her case against him Tuesday. Meanwhile, the BBC was forced to apologize after inviting Epstein lawyer Alan Dershowitz on air to comment on the Maxwell verdict. Dershowitz has also been accused of sexual assault by Virginia Giuffre, a charge he denies. Sudan's civilian prime minister, Abdallah Hamdok, stepped down Sunday, warning Sudan's military leaders are blocking the transition to a fully civilian government. Hamdok was deposed in an October 25th military coup, then restored to power in November. His resignation on Sunday came as Sudanese soldiers killed 3 people protesting for an end to the military rule, pushing the death toll in the post-coup protests to at least 57. The protesters are hoping to topple Sudan's military dictatorship just as they forced longtime ruler Omar al-Bashir from power in 2019.
The international community used to support Omar al-Bashir in his final days, and it wasn't expected that the people in the street would escalate and that protests would turn into a popular revolution. In the end, al-Bashir succumbed to the street. The international community's role comes after people in the street, I think. The international community does not have the final say.
In Hong Kong, the independent media outlet Citizen News is shuttering this week, citing safety concerns, days after authorities raided another independent news organization, Stan News, and arrested at least 7 staffers. This is chief editor of Citizen News, Daisy Lee.
What has changed is not us, but the environment. As the editor-in-chief, nowadays, there are things that I cannot make the decision for. I am unsure whether a story, a piece of news, or a sentence will violate a new regulation under the changing news environment.
This comes as Hong Kong's first so-called patriots-only legislature was sworn in today following last month's election, where all candidates were vetted for their loyalty or selected by pro-Beijing committees. German officials say they've shut down three of the nation's six remaining nuclear plants ahead of a year-end deadline to cease the use of nuclear power. Germany's government says it's on track to phase out the use of coal by 2030 and will continue to scale up renewable energy sources to meet demand for electricity. Back in the United States, President Joe Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris are set to speak at an event Thursday marking the first anniversary of the U.S. Capitol insurrection. On Sunday, Wyoming Congressmember Liz Cheney, the top Republican on the House Select Committee investigating the insurrection, told ABC News former President Trump is, quote, clearly unfit for future office, as she described his refusal to stop the violent mob attack on January 6 for over 3 hours.
We know as he was sitting there in the dining room next to the Oval Office, members of his staff were pleading with him to go on television to tell people to stop. We know Leader McCarthy was pleading with him to do that. We know members of his family. We know his daughter. We have firsthand testimony that his daughter Ivanka went in at least twice to ask him to please stop this violence.
Twitter permanently suspended the personal account of Republican Congressmember Marjorie Taylor Greene for repeatedly posting misinformation about COVID-19. The suspension came after the far-right Georgia lawmaker tweeted over the weekend about, quote, extremely high amounts of COVID vaccine deaths. It was Greene's fifth strike, according to Twitter, which previously temporarily suspended her for other false claims about the pandemic. The disabled Twitter handle was Greene's preferred account, though she still has access to her congressional handle. Karen Ferguson, the longtime labor lawyer who fought to protect workers' pensions and retirement plans, has died at the age of 80. Ferguson was head of the Pension Rights Center for more than four decades, where she successfully lobbied Congress for pension reforms while helping thousands of workers recover their retirement benefits. Ferguson got her start in Washington, D.C., as one of Nader's Raiders, a group of lawyers who joined consumer advocate Ralph Nader's public interest research group in the 70s. In Colorado, Governor Jared Polis reduced the 110-year prison sentence of truck driver Rogel Aguilera Medeiros to 10 years, calling the initial lengthy sentence unjust. The case of Aguilera Medeiros, a 26-year-old driver from Cuba, triggered widespread condemnation, including a boycott of Colorado led by other truck drivers in protest. Aguilera Medeiros has said the brakes on his semi-trailer failed when driving downhill, leading to a multi-vehicle pileup that killed four people in 2019. Many are calling on the trucking company to be held liable for the crash. In South Africa, fighters have tamed a massive blaze that destroyed parts of the South African parliament in Cape Town. A suspect has been arrested in connection with the fire, which had been burning since the early hours of Sunday. No one's injured in the blaze. The building's also home to thousands of national treasures, including rare books, artwork, and historical documents. And in more news from South Africa, friends, family, and supporters paid tribute to anti-apartheid hero Archbishop Desmond Tutu at an official state funeral in Cape Town Saturday. South African President Cyril Ramaphosa delivered the main eulogy during the service at St. George's Cathedral, where he hailed Tutu as our national conscience. Tutu's family also spoke at the ceremony. This is his daughter, the Reverend Nontombi Naomi Tutu.
We thank you for loving our father, grandfather, husband, uncle, brother, brother-in-law. Many of the messages we received have said, thank you for sharing him with the world. Well, it actually is a two-way street. Because we shared him with the world, you shared part of the love you held for him with us.
Archbishop Desmond Tutu died last week at the age of 90. To see our special on Desmond Tutu in his own words, go to democracynow.org. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The United States is now averaging over 400,000 new COVID cases a day as the Omicron variant rapidly spreads across the country. The record-breaking surge is putting a new strain on hospitals, even even though early studies suggest Omicron infections appear to be milder than previous variants. In Washington, D.C., cases are up by 500% over the past 2 weeks. In Puerto Rico, cases are up nearly 1,000%. COVID cases are also rapidly rising globally, with daily new cases surpassing 1 million for the first time as the pandemic enters its third year. In Argentina, nearly 30% of all COVID tests are coming back positive. In China, the city of Xi'an has entered a second week of lockdown. Cases in Australia have reached a new high. We begin today's show looking at vaccine inequity and efforts to vaccinate the world. Last week, the Indian government gave emergency approval to a new low-cost, patent-free vaccine called Corbevax. The vaccine was developed by two doctors at the Texas Children's Hospital Center for Vaccine Development. An Indian company is now aiming to produce 1 billion doses of the vaccine this year to help address the massive shortage of COVID vaccines in the global south. We're joined now by one of the vaccine's creators, Dr. Peter Hotez, co-director of the Center for Vaccine Development at Texas Children's Hospital. His most recent book, Preventing the Next Pandemic, Vaccine Diplomacy in a Time of Anti-Science. Dr. Hotez, welcome back to Democracy Now. Can you link the first part of our lead, what's happening around the world with the speed of the Omicron variant, to what you have now just accomplished, making this patent-free vaccine available to the world? India has just given you emergency approval.
The year of 2021. United States from the Delta and Omicron variant. The reason they arose was because we allowed large unvaccinated populations to go unvaccinated.
Can you repeat what you said at the beginning, Dr. Hotez? We didn't quite get it, and it's absolutely critical.
Well, thanks again for having me. Again, the reason why we have this situation now with Omicron, just like we have the situation with Delta, is we allowed large unvaccinated populations in low and middle income countries to remain unvaccinated. Delta arose out of an unvaccinated population in India in early 2021, and Omicron arose out of a large unvaccinated population on the African continent later in the same year. So these two variants of concern represent failures by global leaders to work with sub-Saharan Africa, Southeast Asia, and Latin America to vaccinate the Southern Hemisphere, vaccinate the Global South. And we got tired of it, so we've decided to do what we've always done for 20 years. When I say we, myself and Dr. Patazzi, as you point out, and our team of 20 scientists, we make vaccines for diseases that the pharma companies won't make, for parasitic infections such as Chagas disease and schistosomiasis. And we adopted a coronavirus program about 10 years ago, and then we flipped that around to make the COVID vaccine. And the only thing we know how to do is make low-cost, straightforward vaccines for use in resource-poor settings. And that was the failure of the global policy leaders. They never had any interest in that. It was always about speed and innovation and to make enough interesting vaccines for North America and Europe without any attention to the rest of the world. So we went the opposite direction, and we worked really hard because, you know, it was very difficult to get funding. We got no support from Operation Warp Speed, no support really from the G7 countries. We're on our own. And now we've licensed our prototype vaccine and helping the co-development to India, Indonesia, Bangladesh, and now Botswana. And India is the furthest along, and we worked with this extraordinary organization known as Biological E that has got a track record of making low-cost vaccines for the world, and we've partnered with them, working with them on a daily or weekly basis. And now that vaccine is being produced by Biological E. They already have 150 million doses ready to go, and they're now producing 100 million doses a month, and that'll get us to 1.2 billion. We're going to need several billion more, and hopefully our other partners in Indonesia, Bangladesh, and Botswana will also have similar successes. So it's really exciting to show that, you know, you don't need to be a multinational pharmaceutical company and just make brand new technologies that will only be suitable for the Northern Hemisphere. We can really make a vaccine for the world, and that's what our goal has always been for the last 20 years, and that's we think we've made an important first step with COVID-19.
Public Citizen has said, quote, Texas Children's Hospital's commitment to sharing technology is a challenge to the pharma giants and the false narrative that vaccine production and medical innovation thrive through secrecy and exclusivity. If Texas Children's Hospital can do it, why can't Pfizer and Moderna? Can you talk about how you were able to do this with so little funding while they are making billions, not to mention billionaires, of their founders and chairs and execs in the companies, while millions now, we are dealing with the largest surge in the history of this pandemic?
Well, you know, the way I look at it is, you know, the multinational pharma companies are the multinational pharma companies. They're going to do what they do, and they've made some good vaccines. And I myself was the beneficiary of the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccines. I think the problem was not balancing the ecosystem, putting all of the eggs in the pharma basket and not recognizing that we have some outstanding vaccine producers in low and middle income countries that are bereft of resources and bereft of some of the technical help they need to get over that hump. And that's what we've been doing now for the last 20 years. The other thing we do is we build capacity. We invite scientists from all over the world to come into our vaccine labs to learn how to make vaccines under a quality umbrella, whereas you cannot walk into Merck or GSK or Pfizer or Moderna and say, show me how to make a vaccine. With our group, we can. And so we think the problem is not balancing that model better. And that's what we're doing now. And, you know, I think for me, the biggest frustration was never really getting that support from the G7 countries. So not only, you know, was I going on cable news networks and talking about the disinformation empire that was building out of the White House in 2020, but trying to raise meager funds just to get started. And fortunately, we were able to get some funding through Texas and New York-based philanthropies. And that made that we raised about $6-7 million. And believe it, with that, we were able to pay our scientists to actually do this, transfer the technology, no patent, no strings attached, to India. Now, as I said, Indonesia, Bangladesh, and Botswana. And that, you know, and of course, we've been getting calls for help all over the world from ministries of science and ministries of health. And, you know, we do what we can. We could do a lot. I mean, if we had even a fraction of the support that, say, Moderna or the other pharma companies had gotten, who knows, we might have been able to have the whole world vaccinated by now.
I mean, this point you raise with Moderna, which got a fortune from U.S. taxpayers. I mean, we're talking about millions, if not $1 billion, to do the research to develop this. And yet they are not willing to share the formula.
Here was the problem. The problem was the policymakers, not only in the U.S., but globally, were so fixed on speed and innovation. You know, it was all about the brand new technologies, rapidly immunizing populations without that situational awareness to understand that when you only rely on a brand new technology, there's a learning curve. We need 9 billion doses of vaccines for sub-Saharan Africa, Latin America, and Southeast Asia. And nobody was able to take a step back, like, as any first year engineering graduate student will tell you, well, you can't go from 0 to 9 billion with the new technology right away. You better balance it with some older traditional technologies. And that was the frustration that we had, that we couldn't persuade the big policymakers that that was the way to go in addition to what they were doing. Fortunately, we were able to do it. We could have done it a lot faster had we had more support, but now we're moving forward. So India, as I said, is now starting to vaccinate its population. They're working to donate vaccines to the COVAX sharing facilities. We'll do it with others. And eventually, we think we can vaccinate the Southern Hemisphere, the Global South, and prevent these future variants from emerging. But, you know, we're still not getting that kind of awareness. You know, for instance, President Biden, and I'm a big fan of the team that the Biden administration has brought on, boasted that, you know, that a couple of weeks ago, right before the new year, that they donated 275 million doses to 110 countries. Well, heck, I mean, we have already matched that with our research institute in Texas, and we're about to exceed it. So I think, you know, we really need the G7 countries to step up in a bigger way, and we think we could help them quite a bit with our technology. It looks really robust. Same technology used to make the recombinant hepatitis B vaccine that's been around for 40 years. Great levels of virus neutralizing antibody, durable, simple refrigeration. Actually has one of the best safety, maybe the best safety profile of any of the COVID vaccines. And now we're doing clinical trials in kids. So the emergency use is for adults, but hepatitis B vaccine has been given to infants for decades. Ours is the same technology. We're doing now step-down studies in kids. So we're hoping that could be the vaccine to immunize kids all over the world as well. The only thing we don't have is a path for the U.S. because we don't have a U.S. partner.
So what exactly does that mean? I mean, you're the Baylor Texas Children's Hospital. The vaccine is called Corbevax. Can you explain the older technology? I mean, Johnson & Johnson also used an older technology, and now, you know, it is not as effective as the Moderna and Pfizer. Can you talk about that and how your vaccine exactly works?
Well, again, the Johnson & Johnson is an adenovirus vector technology. That's never been used before to make a vaccine and anything near the scale. So in that sense, the adenovirus technology is a new technology. Ours is truly an old school technology that's been used to make recombinant hepatitis B vaccine. It's microbial fermentation in yeast. It's even a vegan vaccine, which is kind of interesting. So now our partners in Indonesia are scaling it up, are trying to do this as a halal vaccine for Muslim majority countries, which is pretty exciting as well. And as I said, you know, what we do is we license the technology, we provide the prototype production cell bank, no strings attached, no patent. We help in the co-development, and then the countries themselves and those companies own it. So Corbevax is the one for India, owned by Biological E. They work out the clinical development plan with the Indian regulators and the World Health Organization. We're hands off. We don't try to meddle into their business. We are a believer in this concept of decolonization. There's too many colonial trappings around trying to own technology and dictate to the global South what to do. And for us, that's quite abhorrent. So we do this without strings attached. Once we do our due diligence that we know it's a vaccine producer that has a track record of producing vaccines for the world, then we hand it off to them and help them in any way we can. Again, at our own expense, we help them with the assays. So it's no cost to the developing country vaccine manufacturers who actually call themselves that, the developing country vaccine manufacturers network.
Well, I want to ask what you mean when you say a vegan vaccine or a halal vaccine. How are the others not?
Well, the others often use mammalian cells in some aspects of the process. It's not that it's better or worse. It's just that ours has no animal products in our vaccines, and that makes it a little more straightforward for countries, especially for some of the Muslim majority countries that worry about whether a vaccine is halal or not.
Let me go to Dr. Fauci. This goes to the whole issue of last week, the Centers for Disease Control reducing the recommended isolation time for people with asymptomatic infections to 5 days, down from 10. On Sunday, Dr. Fauci appeared on ABC's This Week and said the CDC is considering updating the isolation guidance after facing widespread criticism.
You're right, there has been some concern about why we don't ask people at that five-day period to get tested. That is something that is now under consideration. The CDC is very well aware that there has been some pushback about that. Looking at it again, there may be an option in that, that testing could be a part of that. And I think we're going to be hearing more about that in the next day or so from the CDC.
In our next segment, we're going to be talking more about testing, but this atrocious lack of testing in the United States makes it impossible for there to be a kind of sane approach to all of this. But the fact that the CDC said people could come back to work, which in some cases, the employers then require workers to come back to work after 5 days without a test. Your response to this?
Yeah, as Tony points out, as Dr. Fauci points out, that they'll probably have to walk that back partly and do an antigen-based test. look, this was a tough call for the CDC as well. I think the Omicron variant, which is just so overwhelming and so disruptive because of its high transmissibility, almost as high as measles, we're trying to balance what they know about the science with the fact that, you know, right now we have to keep our society functioning at some level. The biggest concern, of course, is all the healthcare providers getting knocked out of the workforce because they're at home with COVID, and that creates a dangerous situation. And we heard all weekend about the problems with the airlines and the fact that ground crews are absent, air traffic controllers are absent. So this one of the, you know, each variant has its own unique attributes or its own what I call little shop of horrors in the case of Omicron. It's this incredibly high transmissibility that could be so disruptive socially in maintaining society as we know it. So I think the CDC was trying to balance what makes sense scientifically with the reality of trying to keep the country functioning. I actually don't fault them as much as others do. Yes, I think they probably should have had the antigen test added on afterwards. But, you know, it's tough when you're in the middle of a firestorm to always get it perfect the first time around.
And can you talk about children? I mean, after all, you are at Texas Children's Hospital. The enormous number of children who are now coming down with COVID, but how seriously are they being affected?
Well, I think there's two aspects to this. First of all, we saw this a little bit with the Delta variant here in the South in Texas over the summer, that it was much more transmissible than previous lineages, and kids were getting swept up in it. It wasn't because Delta was selectively targeting kids. And I think that's probably true of Omicron as well. When you have something that's transmissible, a lot of kids are getting infected. And what you're seeing are two types of hospital admissions. First of all, I think there are some kids who are getting admitted for various conditions, and upon testing, routine testing for hospitalization, they're found to be positive. So they may be actually asymptomatic for their COVID, but found to be positive. And I think that's part of the hospitalizations. The other are there are kids who are genuinely sick from COVID-19, and a lot of younger kids as well. And now that schools are opening, especially in the north where transmission is so high, we should expect that trend to continue. And again, it's going to be that 1-2 punch of having kids hospitalized and healthcare workers in pediatric hospitals at home because they're ill from COVID or found to be positive. And I think that's the for me, that's the dangerous situation with COVID-19. Yes, it looks like overall the virus may produce less severe disease, but still enough to cause a pretty steep rise in hospitalizations. We're seeing a 50% to 60% rise in hospitalizations in New York and Washington, D.C., and having that healthcare workforce unable to adequately take care of those hospitalized individuals. One thing that we've learned during the last 2 years of this pandemic is when ERs and emergency rooms and pediatric ICUs or ICUs get overwhelmed, that's when mortality really skyrockets, and that's the danger point that we are with COVID-19. On top of the fact that two of our three monoclonal antibodies do not work for the Omicron variant, and we don't have enough of that third one, Paxlovid is still not here in abundance, so we have to rely on remdesivir that has to be given parenterally. It doesn't work quite as well as Paxlovid, and as we started at the beginning, the diagnostic testing is still a debacle. So when you put all of that stuff in the mix, you've got a very dangerous epidemic here in the United States in the month of January. And of course, this brings us back to how we started our whole conversation, which is all of this was predicted and predictable and preventable had we showed greater resolve to vaccinate the world, especially the world's low and middle income countries.
Finally, you tweeted, since June 2021, 200,000 unvaccinated Americans lost their lives due to COVID despite widespread availability of vaccines. 200,000 Americans needlessly died because they believed disinformation from the far right, you tweeted. However, vaccine hesitancy seems to span the political divide, with left-leaning parents, some refusing to vaccinate themselves or their kids. Your message to those who think vaccines are a profit-making mechanism for big pharma that will pollute their bodies and irreversibly alter their immune system's natural responses?
Well, the first part may be true. Vaccines are clearly have been profitable for Pfizer, Moderna, but it doesn't mean but they can still save your life. So I think that's the message. And we've seen that of those 200,000 Americans who've died since June 1, we now know that 85% were unvaccinated. The other 15% split between partially vaccinated and a few full vaccinated, especially if they were immunocompromised or of extremely high age. But overwhelmingly, it's the unvaccinated who are losing their lives. And overwhelmingly, that is coming from an aggressive campaign of disinformation, what I call anti-science aggression, coming from the conservative news outlets, coming from the members of Congress. You talked about Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene just being taken off Twitter. That's in part because, you know, she's been out there at the CPAC conference and elsewhere discrediting vaccines, she and her colleagues. So we have about a half a dozen members of the U.S. Congress going out of their way to discredit the safety of vaccines, even saying they're political instruments of control or ridiculous things like first they're going to vaccinate you and then they're going to take away your guns and your Bibles. And as absurd as that sounds to us, there's a fourth of the country that actually believes it, and those are the ones who are not getting vaccinated. And we even have far-right think tanks. So to give these far-right groups intellectual cover, academic cover. So this is a whole ecosystem coming from political extremism on the far right, and it's a killer. I've written an article called Anti-Science Kills, because now it's killed 200,000 Americans since last June.
Well, Dr. Peter Hotez, I want to thank you for being with us, co-director of the Center for Vaccine Development at Texas Children's Hospital. Came up with a vaccine that is being made available patent-free to the world. Dr. Hotez's latest book, Preventing the Next Pandemic, Vaccine Diplomacy in a Time of Anti-Science, coming up as the nation faces a massive shortage of rapid COVID tests. We'll speak to a scientist who developed an inexpensive rapid test nearly 2 years ago, but the FDA wouldn't approve it. Stay with it. Deja Vu by Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. As the U.S. faces a shortage of rapid COVID tests amidst the Omicron surge, we turn now to speak to a scientist who developed an inexpensive rapid at-home COVID test nearly 2 years ago, but the FDA refused to approve it. Irina Bosch is the founder of the diagnostic company E25 Bio. She's a visiting professor at MIT, adjunct professor of medicine at Mount Sinai, New York. In March 2020, she submitted the test to the FDA for emergency authorization. The FDA approval never came. It would be another year before more expensive at-home COVID tests began appearing on the market. Today, those tests are hard to come by, if not impossible, as the U.S. grapples with 400,000 new COVID infections a day. Irina Bosch joins us now from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Dr. Bosch, it's great to have you with us. If you can tell us first what happened, and I want to credit an excellent article in ProPublica that brought you to our attention.
Thank you. Yes, it is a very well-done article. And what happened was that in 2020, we had a group of scientists had already made for about 10 years other very similar antigen tests for other viral diseases. So we jumped into COVID basically knowing a bit of what we were doing. So by April, we had already made a test. By July, we completed our first clinical trial in the United States. And indeed, it was the first submission to the FDA. It was this one. But then short after we presented the data, we learned that it was going to be really hard to meet the standards. We, of course, agree with having excellent tests being approved, at that time, we thought the standards were ill-defined and they were too harsh for meeting the requirements. Other than that, the test was excellent and it could have been approved under 2021 standards.
I want to interrupt for a second to remind people that the U.S. government came out with a test that was faulty at the beginning.
It was a different test. They were faulty because they were doing PCR, which is molecular test, not antigen test, and they made a mistake in the primers, which are part integral part of this molecular test. Yes, they made a mistake, which was a huge one, but they repaired the damage. And for PCR or molecular tests, you can actually quickly in the lab iterate and fix it. But for antigen tests, FDA does not allow scientists like us to validate and approve the behavior of these tests in the lab. You have to do clinical trials, but not for PCR.
Right. So explain why you were turned down and how many tests you could have gotten out there related to what we're seeing now, this massive lack of testing available.
Yeah. So generally, when you make these kinds of very simple tests, it's just a strip. The robot that makes these could make millions a week. So the number is a non-issue. We had really good manufacturers lined up to make these tests for us and for United States. So that's not a problem. So numbers are easily made available. Moreover, what happened to that particular case that we refer to, the E25 bio test, happened to other companies. Basically, the requirements were such, and perhaps maybe lack of experience. I mean, we were all new in the pandemic experience, right? FDA could have understand the way these antigen tests are meant to be used. And the reason why I say that is because for diagnostic only, like PCR, you have to be really super precise and you have to be, you know, very, very sensitive. For antigen tests that you use almost every day, anytime, anywhere, anyone, that's kind of the three things that one day Anthony Fauci said, that's how we will control the pandemic. These antigen tests work beautifully if you use them repeatedly. So basically that was the issue. There were no directives or well set forth in 2020 for the use of the antigen test. So antigen tests can offer so much more.
I want to go to what the FDA recently responded to the ProPublica report about COVID-19 rapid test that you created in March 2020. In the statement, FDA said, unfortunately, many submissions the FDA has received for home tests include incomplete or poor data, and it's the FDA's responsibility to protect the public health by declining to authorize poorly performing tests or those without complete data. If the FDA received a home test that the data and science supported in early to mid-2020, we would have quickly authorized it. Can you respond to this, Dr. Bosch?
Yeah, of course that we want FDA to protect the public. I mean, as a scientist, we completely agree with that. What we don't agree is that if you have ways to validate a test that are not the best or are way too strict, meaning you compare the PCR with like a huge expansion of the genome to a detection of a protein in your nasal cavity. So that's the problem of the FDA. The FDA forgot to add to that quote, indeed, we were mistaken. It would have been so nice to hear that.
So people now know PCR tests take more time and they are more precise. But the country is now accepting, the government is now accepting that these antigen tests like yours is critical to day-to-day functioning. So explain when you say what's essential is the repeated test and explain why we are where we are today.
Yeah, so this is very important question because 50% of people with COVID do not present symptoms. So they will not get a PCR, they will not go to the doctor, they will not go to a hospital. So they're around just spreading the disease everywhere. So the only the only mobile or deployable device is actually an antigen test, because it doesn't need specialized apparatuses. It doesn't need specialized technology that you need a nurse. You can do it yourself. So by having 50% of cases being, or even more now, of cases that do not present a symptom, you ought to do it regularly in order to detect a asymptomatic case. So regularly means, under the today's circumstances, you would have to do twice a week, minimum once a week, so that you can catch the 12th day of expansion of your viral infection. So that's what I mean with frequency. We just found out in 2020, we did another clinical trial for home use, and we found out that if you repeat antigen tests more than one day in a row, it reaches the same sensitivity as PCR. So those things FDA does not necessarily know, or they have not acquired that knowledge into the regulatory body, which is sad.
So did other countries approve the rapid, quick COVID tests early on? I mean, countries like Britain, like Korea, and did it make a difference in their country in the spread of COVID?
So Asia and Europe did approve many, many antigen tests. 40 different brands, whereas in the United States, you have barely like a handful. And so it is true that other countries had a completely different take on how these antigen tests would work. Indeed, they understood that there is a range of virus where this antigen test will detect beautifully day 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, but then it decays. So those countries that acquire that knowledge sooner than the regulatory body of USA, they actually did better. They deploy them to the population, and they're super inexpensive. We hear that in Germany, you could buy a test for 50 cents of a dollar. So that's not the case for USA.
I mean, USA, the Binex test is what, like $23, $25 for two tests. This is expensive if you're expected to do this every single week, and let alone unavailable.
Absolutely. So these tests, because we made them before, we know you can make them at 50 cents at cost. Maybe, you know, you would say, okay, I'll sell them for a dollar or two or three. It's still like a decent margin for companies to return their investment. By all means, they don't cost that much. And moreover, which is super important, these antigen tests can be now understood by a cell phone, and it becomes a super fancy gadget, because the cell phone takes a picture of the test immediately in the cloud, or immediately in real time, you know it's a positive or negative, and you can disperse that data on the fly. So you have something simple linked to a mobile technology to make it a really efficient monitoring tool.
Finally, you are now working to help other test developers carry out trials that will meet FDA regulations, even though they say they are wrong now, the FDA. Can you talk about efforts in a low-income Boston area to do the testing you feel needs to be done at this point?
Yeah, we found out that the at-home test by mandates of the USA regulatory requires a mobile phone, and many people don't even have access to that mobile phone. And we centered our attention to the more underprivileged population. Sometimes they only speak Spanish, sometimes they're elderly. So we're now working in Chelsea, Massachusetts, to enable and educate the population on how they could use the rapid test. All the tests we deployed in our study had been validated in Europe, in Asia, and in the lab. So they're highly performing, even some better than some of the FDA-approved ones. So we do not deploy anything that we don't know that it will perform well. And moreover, we teach them how to use the app, the phone app. So yes, it's a very interesting project. We're looking forward to work with the community for the next 4 months.
Irina Bosch, I want to thank you for being with us, founder of the diagnostic company E25 Bio, adjunct professor of medicine at Mount Sinai, visiting scientist at Massachusetts Institute of Technology, developed an inexpensive rapid test just weeks into the pandemic that the FDA turned down. When we come back, we look at the climate change-fueled fires that have ripped through the suburbs of Denver and Boulder, the state's most devastating wildfire in history. Stay with us. Fool Me by the Denver-based funk band The Motet. The drummer and founder of the band, Dave Watts, lost his home and three pets in the recent wildfire. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Yes, in Colorado, the still smoking remains of homes destroyed by the state's most devastating wildfires in history are now covered in snow. Last Thursday, fast-spreading climate change-fueled wildfires tore through the towns of Superior and Louisville, Colorado, suburbs of Denver and Boulder, with little notice, as described in this video by an eyewitness.
We're across the golf course in a pond, and we look out to that. So as I pan to the left here, we see huge fires on the other side of 36 right there. Significant fires. And then over here, more fires.
The origin of the wildfires under investigation. The flames were fanned by winds that gusted up to 110 miles per hour. Louisville, Colorado resident Paul Bassis saw his home nearly destroyed in the blaze.
Climate change is here now. That this is not some future threat that we have to deal with at some point someday, but this is here and now. People lost their belongings, their memories that were in those homes, families that were raised there.
The Marshall Fire destroyed about 1,000 homes and businesses, and at least two people are still missing and presumed dead. It caps a year of drought across the western U.S., came as temperatures in Colorado between June and December were the warmest on record. A report by NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's Drought Task Force, found without, quote, stringent climate mitigation, the region will continue to warm. For more, we go to Boulder, Colorado, to speak with Dr. Jennifer Balch, director of the Earth Lab at the University of Colorado Boulder. Welcome to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us. Very painful under these circumstances. Can you explain what happened? I mean, you yourself, one of your own scientists, Matt Ross, lost his home in the fire.
That's right. I have many friends and colleagues who lost homes. This has been a disaster, and I'll go back to basics to try and explain what happened here, but you need three ingredients for fires. You need it to be warm, you need fuels to burn, and you need a spark or ignition source. We had all three, and as you mentioned, we had one of the warmest periods during our fall and winter on record for the Front Range, which stretches from Colorado Springs to Fort Collins. And leading up to that, we also had a lot of grasses that grew as a function of a really wet spring. So we had a lot of grass fuel. We had very warm conditions, which meant our fuels were very dry. And we had an ignition source that's still under investigation. And what made this fire a disaster were two things. One, there were a lot of homes in the way. Thousands of homes have been built into the landscape between Denver and Boulder over the last several decades. And we had very high wind conditions. So those factors together essentially gave us the right conditions for this type of event and this type of disaster. In the western U.S., You know, we have millions of homes that are in what is called the wildland-urban interface, or where homes intermingle with vegetation. And work that we did demonstrates that over a million homes over the roughly the last two decades were within wildfire boundaries. And another 59 million homes were within a kilometer of those wildfires. So we're living with very high fire risk, and we don't even know it.
Can you compare what happened in Boulder to what took place in Oregon and California, the size of these fires? I mean, this isn't even the largest wildfire in Colorado, but it's the most destructive in a century.
That's right. And it's among the most destructive wildfires in U.S. history as well. It's not just in Colorado. So the fact that 1,000 homes burned to the ground is remarkable. And comparing to Oregon and California, I think one thing that's really important to note here is that this is a winter wildfire, and that is an oxymoron. There's only one other time in my career when I've talked about snow putting out wildfires. And so this to me is an important signal, and we've seen this signal across the West. We know that since the 1980s, the amount of forests that have burned has doubled, and that's directly tied to how warm our temperatures are and essentially how dry our fuels have become. We've known that there's a link between climate change and wildfires for over a decade, and it takes just a little bit of warming to lead to a lot more burning, and that's what we're seeing. You know, we no longer have a fire season. We have fires all year round. And, you know, this wildfire is small relative to some of the fires in California and Oregon that happened over this summer and happened over the last summer. It's 6,000 acres relative to some of the biggest wildfires we've seen in the lower 48. We saw a million-acre fire over the last couple of years. So this is a small fire, but what made it a disaster is that there are a lot of homes in the way. And that has to do with our development patterns and how we're building into flammable landscapes. There's a lot we can do to change how we build into flammable places.
What can be done?
So we need to rethink how we're building. There's a lot of materials that we can use that are not as flammable. So when we build with wood siding and asphalt roofing and wood decks, those are all flammable materials. We have building codes that make us install sprinklers in inside homes and inside industrial buildings, but we don't have the equivalent building codes to protect our homes from wildfires. California is on the leading edge of this, and now other states need to think seriously about how we're building homes into flammable places. All of Colorado is flammable. Our grasses are flammable, our shrubs are flammable, our trees are flammable. This is a dry landscape that's flammable most of the year now. And so we need to rethink how we're building into these places.
And the drought. Can you talk about the effect of what this historic 20-year drought before the wildfire from July to December, Denver recorded the lowest amount of precipitation?
Yeah, so moisture is another huge factor. So it's not only temperature increase, it's also how much moisture we're getting. And we didn't get a lick of moisture in this region before this wildfire started. And so how much rain or snow we get plus warm temperatures essentially equates to really, really dry fuels and dry over a period of time. And not only that, but the plants are stressed out. And so they die and they become dead fuel to burn, which is much more flammable. I mean, essentially what happened with this fire in the first few hours was that it moved through an open space that was essentially a grassland. It had an entire runway of grass to go through for several miles before it started to hit neighborhoods. And essentially what that meant was there was a very long active fire line that was moving towards those homes in very dry fuels.
What do you say to climate change deniers like, Colorado's own Congress member Lauren Boebert?
Oh, it's frustrating. The science has been known for over a decade that there's a link between warming and wildfires, and we need to move past it and acknowledge it in order to build solutions. You know, we're essentially sitting ducks to the repercussions of climate change if we don't acknowledge it. And I think part of the solution is acknowledging it and figuring out how we can live with increasing fire in the future. We're going to build back, but I hope that Colorado builds back smarter, thinking about how we can build more fire-resilient homes and fire-resilient communities moving forward.
We're going to leave it there. I want to thank you so much for being with us, Dr. Jennifer Balch, director of the Earth Lab at the University of Colorado Boulder. And that does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman. Remember, wearing a mask is an act of love.
RCT, in sound, from way out.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we speak with Oliver Stone regarding his new documentary film, JFK Revisited, Through the Looking Glass.
This is a crucially important documentary. It points the finger, in my personal opinion, at the CIA and particularly its fired director, Alan Dulles, on the assassination of JFK. And what happened after that has changed the course of American history.
We also take a look at the trend to privatize waste and water utilities. We'll talk with two National Lawyers Guild attorneys about the financial and environmental consequences. Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
And I'm Jim Lafferty, a decades-long political activist and once the national director of the National Lawyers Guild. President John F. Kennedy was assassinated on November 22, 1963. That's 58 years ago. That assassination is a political murder, of course, and his murder was a turning point in American history. The first question needed to be asked in a murder case is why? The second question, of course, is who? Today we discuss this catastrophic turn in American history with filmmaker Oliver Stone, who directed his just-released new documentary, JFK Revisited, Through the Looking Glass. Stone uses evidence from the Assassination Record Review Board to bolster our understanding that the assassination was not accomplished by a lone individual, Lee Harvey Oswald. Kennedy was killed because he was pushing for a detente. He wanted to end the nuclear arms race with the Soviet Union. He wanted to get American troops out of Vietnam and end its counter-revolutionary involvement in many places around the world. President Kennedy wanted to reestablish relations with Castro and revolutionary Cuba. He wanted to support the independence of countries like the Congo. It was for this that he was murdered, and the course of American history was changed. One of the first things the new President Lyndon Johnson did, he had been Kennedy's vice president, after he was installed, was to reverse Kennedy's order initiating the withdrawal of American troops in Vietnam. Instead, Johnson escalated the war, eventually putting 500,000 American soldiers on the battlefield in that war, killing some 3 million Vietnamese people, and of course, over 53,000 American soldiers died in that war as well. Stone's 1991 movie JFK was nominated for 4 Oscars, winning 2 of them. His new documentary, JFK Revisited Through the Looking Glass, has been pretty much ignored by the mainstream America media. We have greatly admired Oliver Stone for years, and we are proud now to have him as a guest on our show. Oliver Stone, welcome to Law and Disorder Radio. I came away from watching your documentary feeling, number one, clearly, Lee Harvey Oswald, if he had anything to do with it all, it was not the lone shooter, quote unquote. Secondly, the CIA and the FBI seem to be the most likely suspects, if you will, in this. And one also comes away from your film wondering about Lyndon Johnson himself. So what would you say is your own belief, having done all the work and the research you've done for years on this, as to the answer to that question, who effectuated the murder?
It was in the days right after the assassination when Alsop, Joseph Alsop, who was a columnist, very respected, called Johnson with a suggestion that he had to get an impeccable commission together to prove, to show that Oswald had done it alone. That was always the goal, because Johnson